policy, which he directs at the University of Michigan. He is also a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Fellow, and a member of the MacArthur Foundation Research Network on Transitions to Adulthood. His research focuses on trends in poverty and inequality and the effects of economic and demographic changes in government social programs on disadvantaged groups. Sheldon has written widely on the effects of the 1996 welfare reform on employment and economic well-being of single mothers. He is co-author of America Unequal and Detroit Divided, and co-editor of numerous books, including Understanding Poverty, Working and Poor, The Price of Independence, The Economics of Early Adulthood, and Changing Poverty. I'm honored to welcome Margaret Sims to SSA and the University of Chicago. In 2007, she returned to the Urban Institute as Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., and currently directs the Low-Income Working Families Project. Prior to joining the Urban Institute in July 2007, she was Vice President at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. She's widely recognized, particularly among African Americans, as a member of Black Enterprise Magazine's Board of Economists, a position she's held since 1987. Her contributions and disappointment have been instructive to me as an emerging scholar on how academics can effectively engage the lay public. Dr. Sims has held academic appointments at Atlanta University and the University of California at Santa Cruz. She has edited many books and monographs on Black economic well-being and has written extensively on issues of employment and training, education, income and poverty, and minority business development. Dr. Sims served as editor of the Review of Black Political Economy from 1983 to 1988. She is an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and currently serves on the National Research Council Committee on the Fiscal Future of the United States. She received a PhD in economics from Stanford University. Please join me in welcoming these distinguished scholars to the podium. The Adulthood and Changing Poverty. I'm honored to welcome Margaret Sims to SSA and the University of Chicago. In 2007, she returned to the Urban Institute as Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., and currently directs the Low-Income Working Families Project. Prior to joining the Urban Institute in July 2007, she was Vice President at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. She's widely recognized, particularly among African Americans, as a member of Black Enterprise Magazine's Board of Economists, a position she's held since 1987. Her contributions and disappointment have been instructive to me as an emerging scholar on how academics can effectively engage the lay public. Dr. Sims has held academic appointments at Atlanta University and the University of California at Santa Cruz. She has edited many books and monographs on Black economic well-being and has written extensively on issues of employment and training, education, income and poverty, and minority business development. Dr. Sims served as editor of the Review of Black Political Economy from 1983 to 1988. She is an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and currently serves on the National Research Council Committee on the Fiscal Future of the United States. She received a PhD in economics from Stanford University. Please join me in welcoming these distinguished scholars to the podium.
On the program, and I think the morning sessions were terrific, and I just realized that seven people who were on the program, I've had the good fortune to have in my class or be on their committee or in Waldo's place to be his postdoc mentor. So they're it's terrific to come to an academic conference where I have an interest in the topic, but when I get to hear my former students, that's terrific. And Heather Hill stole a lot of my thunder, so if I repeat some of the things she says, I guess it's because I agree with her. I'm going to talk about sort of a macroeconomic perspective on the low-wage labor market. The title of my talk, 35 Years and Still Going Strong, really relates to sort of a sea change that occurred in the economy and that's still going on in the economic boom that started at the end of World War II. We basically had a quarter century of rising real wages, increasing access to pensions and health insurance. Jobs got better, unemployment got lower, wages got higher, and recessions were pretty minor. And then the oil price shock of 1973 issued in an era in which we still find ourselves, despite the fact that we had two really very long economic expansions, one in the 1980s and one in the 1990s. Yet, if one looks back over these 35 years, one sees an era of slow economic growth and rising inequality and a dramatic increase in the low-wage labor market, which is the focus of the talk today. And again, a number of people have touched on these, but I think most people agree that a combination of labor market policies, the erosion of the minimum wage, the difficulty that unions have organizing, globalization, and particularly, in my view, labor-saving technological changes were all factors. And the role of labor-saving technological practices was driven home. This morning we talked about employers, but then somebody mentioned what about the supply side. And we should all realize that we, maybe I should only say me, but I think others, are the beneficiaries of labor-saving technological changes, which has, in fact, led to an increase in the low-wage labor market. And I was just reminded of this because Ann Arbor has this bookstore that everybody loves, this independent bookstore called Shame and Drum, and yet labor-saving technological change, I buy all my books at Amazon because I don't have to leave my office. So unless I want to browse for a travel book or something like that where I really want to browse, if, you know, Scott Allard's book come out and I want to buy Scott Allard's book, I just go to Amazon and click, and this institution is collapsing, and with it what presumably were good jobs and good wages for the firms. And there are lots of labor-saving technological changes like that that have made life better for consumers but have created the concerns in the labor market that we have more low-wage jobs, fewer middle-wage jobs, and more high-wage jobs. These economic changes are at work in most economies, but their labor market and social welfare policies restrained the growth of low-wage work. And Aixa Cintron, another former student of mine, talked about the Russell Sage Project this morning, and those volumes from Russell Sage talk a lot about the choices other countries make. So while the labor market changes are similar, the policy changes are different. Finally, I'll say something about new policies that will do more to help make work pay, to help parents balance work and family responsibilities. But I think there's little chance that dramatic policy changes will transform the low-wage labor market. I think we'll have, I'm optimistic about the Obama administration's changes, and Margaret's going to talk in her comments significantly about those. But I don't think the economy is going to transform the low-wage labor market. If anything, it's likely to increase. Now, to the extent that I'm pessimistic about the low-wage labor market continuing to grow, economists are notoriously bad about making predictions. And so when I first got to Wisconsin as a postdoc, Robert Lampman had just written a book in which he predicted that based on the economic conditions of the periods from 1950 to 1970, poverty as we officially measure it would be eliminated by 1980. And so there were unforeseen changes, namely the labor market shocks that started in 1973 that made those predictions wrong. So, you know, maybe we not only have a golden age in public policy coming in with the Obama administration, where at least I think the Reagan era of social policy is over, but maybe a golden age of the labor market is around the corner. But I, my talk is going to be based on the assumption that these labor market changes, which are 35 years and going, don't show much turning around. Again, the changes were touched upon a little bit this morning. Heather mentioned the particular difficulties of males, but particularly the employment and earnings of male high school graduates and dropouts have dropped dramatically compared to those of male college graduates and women in all educational groups. Minorities have lower educational attainment, so they're more negatively affected by race-neutral labor market policies. In other words, the collapse of General Motors and the auto industry is not a race-specific policy, but a large percentage of the good jobs that African Americans, particularly African American men with a high school degree or less, had disappeared. There are obviously still race-specific factors. Just yesterday at Michigan, we heard Bill Wilson talk about his new book, which is going to be reviewed in the New York Times tomorrow. And Bill clearly articulates the continuing role of race in the labor market. Women's educational attainment has increased relative to that of young men, and that explains in part the relative erosion of men's employment and earnings relative to women, and a smaller percentage of men can now support a family on their own wages. So those are the key changes that I see as continuing. Again, just to touch on the U.S. Labor market differences with Europe. Again, this is an advertisement for Russell Sage Books. Richard Freeman has a terrific book called America Works, which is a very small book, so it's great to assign students because they don't like long books. And this was discussed this morning, particularly the chart from Anna's presentation about Canadian workers have a lot of these things that U.S. workers don't. So our minimum wage is lower. Employers here don't have to provide paid vacations, sick leave, maternity leave, and it's easier for firms to resist unionization. On the policy side, we provide a smaller percentage of the unemployed get benefits for a smaller percentage of the time. The stimulus package has made improvements in UI, and I expect the Obama administration will do more over the next several years in that area. We have fewer family benefits, fewer housing benefits, and obviously high-income Americans pay lower taxes than high-income Europeans, which it's those higher taxes that allow Europe to pay those paid sick leave and other kinds of benefits. Just to show you the average wage, this is the BLS series of production workers. The point to take away is that the real wage was about $17 in the 1970s, and it's about that in 2006. So we've had this 35 years with no wage growth on average. In fact, if you look at the published census data, whenever I give a talk to an audience where the typical listener believes that poor people are poor because they don't work, I have a chart from the census, which I don't have here, which shows that the real wage of full-time, the real annual earnings of male full-time, full-year workers was about $40,000 and change in 1973 and is about $40,000 and change in 2006. Now, this year it will probably go down. And I can remember giving one talk and somebody saying, that can't be right. But this does show for workers and obviously the erosion of the average, the minimum wage relative to the average. These data, and you've got them in your handouts if it's hard to see, this is really the collapse in the labor market for high school graduates. I have data from 75 to 2006 from the current population survey. These happen to be for young men because it was something for the MacArthur Network on the transition to adulthood, but if you do 25 to 54, it's not much difference. Another number that some people have a hard time believing is that in 2006, the median annual earnings of white high school graduates is lower than the 1975 median annual earnings of black high school graduates. So both all the race groups declined, but you see the roughly 32,700 for African Americans in 1975 and the 30,000 today. So these are the reasons if this is happening. These include anybody who worked at all during the year. The results for women are different. They're mostly up. The median annual earnings for women workers will be affected both by their wage rate and by their hours. And over this period, there's a dramatic increase in hours of work among women, but there's still an inflation-adjusted increase in wages. This shows that within each of the three largest race ethnic groups, women gained relative to men. This is particularly for white women, 45% to 75%. And then the bottom panel, women for white, black, and Hispanic women each gained relative to white men over this period. So I'm not going to go into the discussion, but there's a lot of discussion about the role of men being able to support a family and the role of women's independence in explaining some of the family changes. While the previous charts were actually, I guess one would say, biased upward because you had to be a worker to get into the chart. And what this shows is really the collapse in work among young men with, actually this chart is 25 to 54, men with a high school degree or less. This is employment in the week prior to the current population survey. And you can see a dramatic decline of almost 20 percentage points among blacks in the bottom, a 10-point change in employment for whites. There's the book by Edelman, Holzer, and Offner about reconnecting disadvantaged men, or some that's close enough, disconnected men, deals with these issues. And again, the contrast with women is dramatic because women in all three of the groups had a dramatic increase in work effort. I'm going to skip very quickly. This is the percentage of men and women who earn enough to support a family of four at the poverty line, which is about 24,000. And again, you can see this dramatic increase from 17% in 1973. 17% of men in this education group could not support a family of four, and that doubled to 34%. So, since you've got my handout, I thought I would simply give a little summary of where I think things are going, because I want to make sure Margaret has her time and we have time for questions. But it seems to me that we have to at least take the position that there are going to be a large number of low-wage workers, men and women, for the foreseeable future. It's 35 years getting into this. If you look at the time series data closely, the 1990s were great on the employment chart. There was a big increase in black male employment during the 90s, which has eroded. We're obviously in the worst labor market since the 30s, so 3 years from now, when if we look at the data through 2009, it can't be good. So what can we do? In the short run, there are, I'd say, three relatively simple policy groupings, and they're listed on the charts. I call a work-centered anti-poverty strategy, support for workers in one- and two-parent families, and raising educational attainment and skills of disadvantaged children. One thing that's remarkable, and you won't see it in the handouts, I went in and where I have the asterisks on the PowerPoint, they show up in red for what the Obama administration has been able to do in the last month in a lot of the areas is quite dramatic. Again, to borrow from Heather, if wages are going to be low, even if one got a lot of favorable action to increase the minimum wage to make it easier for employers to unionize, let's say we'd be in a dream world where we knock down that 34% of men back to 20%. I can't imagine going back that far, but even if we did, there are still a lot of reasons to think that we could make work pay, particularly an earned income tax credit for singles, more subsidized child care. That was one of the good things that came out of the 1996 welfare reform, was the big increase in spending on child care subsidies. And then my particular favorite, transitional jobs of last resort, which really are not on the table. I think that's too big of a leap even for the stimulus package. I had been hoping there would be some earmarked transitional jobs in the stimulus package. My reading, and I have not read it as carefully as I might, but I did find something about jobs for low-income elderly and youth summer programs. So, you know, at least there's the foot in the door getting back the provision of public employment. And what is it about summer jobs for youth and low-income elderly? That's not controversial if when you start saying earmark 5% of the jobs for ex-offenders and welfare mothers who've run out their time limits. That's a little more controversial. The second goal, and I have to give credit for this being in there to another one of my former students, Maria Kanchan. Some of this talk comes from the introductory chapter of the book that Waldo mentioned, Changing Poverty, which will be out in time for you to use in your classes from Russell Sage in August. And so Maria said, you can't not talk about work-family balance and trying to help parents balance work and caregiving, and a lot of people discussed that this morning. The third goal goes back to a goal of the original War on Poverty, and that is a hand up and not a hand out. Increase investments in education and training. I think it's still quite controversial how much of that should be in workforce development and second chance programs, but there was a big increase in Head Start, in early Head Start. So my takeaway is I don't think the era of the low-wage labor market is over. That makes things very difficult. On the other hand, I do think the Reagan era is over, and there are lots of promising policies, many of which were touched on this morning and I presume will be touched on later, and I know Margaret's going to talk about them now, that could at least do a lot more to offset low-wage labor than we've done to date. Thanks.
I don't have a PowerPoint either, and I guess, you know, now that I heard Virginia Parks talk about Bob Solow, I can, in the future when I don't have one, can say I'm aspiring to be a Nobel laureate. I'm pleased to be here with this group. It's been a fascinating morning. Can't say I've learned new things, but I've learned new details about the low-wage labor market that I think is very important, as somebody pointed out this morning, to try to understand how these jobs are structured and how they vary really helps you understand where and where not policy can be helpful. Sheldon has clearly shown how the low-wage labor market has grown over the past 30 years and how the prospect for high school dropouts and for those without a high school diploma have declined. I'm going to talk a little more broadly than just poverty about the low-income working family, because that's the group that I work the most with in terms of my policy perspectives. There are over 13.4 million families with children. One-third of all families with children fall into the low-income category, defined as families with incomes less than twice the federal poverty line, or about $42,000 for a family of four. Nearly three-quarters of these families have at least one employed adult, though not all are working full-time. Over 60% of the working adults have a high school education or less, so they're clearly in that group most disadvantaged by changes in the labor market. How we address the problem created by these labor market trends can have an impact on the level of inequality in our country and the prospects for the future generation. For many social policy analysts and advocates, the prospect of a new presidential administration inspires hope that poverty reduction and deficiencies in our safety net would be a major focus of attention in Washington and across the country. However, one might ask, is this the best time to push for the types of change we need? Some would say no, because federal deficits are too large and state budgets are under severe pressure trying to meet current needs. High unemployment and business failures will further deplete government reserves, and businesses struggling for survival are not likely to accept new initiatives that require higher business taxes or new employee benefits. Others would say, yes, this is the time. The time is ripe to rethink the role of public policy and governmental action. More families have a sense of vulnerability and are more likely to recognize that the market alone cannot solve all of the problems we currently face. To paraphrase a statement by Bill Galston that appeared in the New York Times recently, policymakers have not all bought the idea of bigger government, but President Obama has an opening to make his case. Several opportunities to promote change around family economic well-being are already on the horizon. The President has asked Vice President Biden to head a task force on middle-class families, which could incorporate upward mobility in its agenda. This task force held its first meeting in Philadelphia a week ago and did, in fact, address the issue of upward mobility in their report on green jobs. In addition, a number of key programs are up for reauthorization in President Obama's first term. The Workforce Investment Act is slated for reauthorization this year, and preliminary hearings are already underway. TANF, or Temporary Assistant for Needy Families, is due for reauthorization in 2010. Both programs are candidates for redesign so that they can better meet the needs of people in vulnerable families who need additional skills or income support when they are without wage income. I'm not going to lay out a complete plan for achieving our principal goal. Instead, I will summarize some goals for policy reform that could be a part of an overall plan to reduce poverty and increase upward mobility. Then I will talk a little about the stimulus package and whether some aspects of it move us in the direction of our goal. I focus on that rather than the new budget because the stimulus package has already been passed and might better represent what is politically achievable. And in addition, the budget released by the President does not have a lot of detail in it. They say that will come in April. Finally, I will raise some possibilities for research that would facilitate achievement of our policy goals. If one wanted to press for new policies that would reduce poverty and put low-income families on the path to self-sufficiency, what goals should we be aiming for? I will draw on some recent work by the low-income working families team for a new safety net to talk about what it might look like. One obvious way to increase family well-being is to increase the wages of the adult workers in the family. This might include strategies such as increasing the minimum wage, increasing the skill levels of adult workers in the family, and increasing employment stability. The last campaign to increase the federal minimum wage was long and hard-fought, but advocates succeeded in getting it increased in stages. The impact will be significant for some workers, particularly those living in the South, where the states do not have minimum wages or follow the federal minimum. But for others, it will have little impact. Many states already have minimums above the rising federal rate. And in fact, the average wage for low-skill workers is around $11 an hour. That exceeds the legislated minimum wage of $7.25, scheduled to go into effect in July of this year. An alternative or complementary approach to increasing the minimum wage is to focus on ways of increasing job stability and improving the skills of low-wage workers. The current workforce development system is not up to the task for several reasons. Too little funding, performance measures that lean against serving those most in need, and a lack of stipends and other supports essential for working parents. The latter is particularly important for some of the populations we're interested in because current TANF regulations don't allow for a lot of time spent in training or education in terms of the work requirements for most recipients. A training system that is responsive to the needs of working families will need to provide good skills training that is connected to existing or anticipated job markets and is offered in a way that is consistent with the parents' need to juggle work, training, and parenting responsibilities. In addition to improving skills, policy should be designed to promote job stability. For working parents, having stable child care arrangements can be important, as can workplace flexibility and paid leave. Not being able to tend to children's needs, caring for a sick child, attending school meetings, or dealing with a child care problem can put a parent's job at risk. And if they lose a job, they can lose their child care subsidy and then go to the end of the waiting line once they are reemployed. Since they cannot keep their subsidy when they are looking for work, it's very hard to engage in an intensive job search. Now, beyond child care, more attention needs to be paid to improving educational outcomes for children, something that Sheldon alluded to when he talked about the next generation. Being attentive to children's development has a double benefit of reducing intergenerational transmission of low-income status. If you can provide the resources children need to advance, then you reduce the size of the next generation of low-income workers. Unfortunately, attention is beginning to focus heavily on early childhood development, possibly to the detriment of programs that address other important developmental periods in children's lives. Even if many of these strategies are adapted, there will still be families that, through their own efforts, are unable to earn enough to reach an income level that exceeds the low income threshold. Therefore, a comprehensive strategy for improving economic well-being would include an increase in disposable income by subsidizing expenses such as housing, child care, and health care, and by increasing take-home pay through the earned income tax credit and other measures. Finally, helping families weather tough times can also help reduce poverty by bolstering income and allowing people to build savings in good times to support themselves during the hard times. Unemployment compensation can also be important in keeping families out of poverty when a major breadwinner loses a job. According to the Congressional Budget Office, 40% of families with an unemployed adult worker are kept out of poverty because of unemployment compensation. But even when employed, low-income families, and many middle-income families as well, find it difficult to make ends meet and save for the future. Policies that encourage savings and reduce the burden of debt are important. Low-income workers are disproportionately the victims of payday loans and other high interest rate lending and need greater access to traditional financial instruments. In today's environment, they will have an even more difficult time without government initiatives. Now, how does the stimulus package try to address the policy needs of low-income working families? And more importantly, given the theme of today's conference, how does it inform the policy research needs of today? The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 is, as the old saying goes about the camel, a horse put together by a committee, or in this case, several committees of Congress. As the name implies, it tries to marry programs to stimulate the economy and promote recovery with programs designed to raise the federal government's stake in various socially advantageous programs. But some see the two as contradictory goals. The point of stimulus is to rev up the economy and then have the spending go away. But investment is often a long-term activity. You have to continue the investment until you get the yield you are looking for. Judging by the magnitude of the problem, dealing with two generational policy issues will take far longer than it will take us to get the economy back on track, or we certainly hope that the economy recovers before we solve the problems of low-income families. It is helpful to think about the contents of the stimulus package in three parts. How does it contribute to reducing poverty in the short term? How might it help states, localities, individuals, and organizations plan for the long term? And what will researchers do, or what can researchers do, to inform policies in this area? The Act includes funds for job creation, mainly in building or rebuilding infrastructure, subsidies for cash and in-kind assistance to individuals through a variety of programs, including TANF, tax credits, cuts, unemployment compensation, and Medicaid. It provides support for all levels of education, invests in early childhood development, and provides funds for training adult workers and work experience for youth. It also expands support for research. Now, some argued when the bill was being considered that this is not stimulus, but it was pointed out that researchers spend money too. Let's take an example or two in terms of potential impact on low-wage workers and their families. There are several provisions in ARRA, as it's called in Washington, for construction jobs, infrastructure such as highways and roads, and jobs that focus on greening federal buildings. In the short term, there may be a large number of jobs generated, but the proportion that are likely to go to low-skilled workers may be quite limited. Construction is one of the industries that has a very high unemployment rate, so most jobs are likely to go to those who were previously employed in these types of jobs. There are also jobs in weatherization where the funds increase is quite substantial. However, they are not likely to be high-paying jobs. And another aspect is the gender issue, and that is that most construction jobs go to men, which is why one reason the unemployment rate for men is higher than it is for women right now. But the unemployment rate for women maintaining families alone in the latest figures is 10.3%, up from 6.7% a year ago. There actually is some public service job possibility under the contingency fund for TANF, which states can choose to draw from but don't have to. It's an 80-20 mix. And there is a provision that they can use some of the funds either for a one-time payment, a cash payment, or for a public service job. But it will be interesting to see what states choose to do, because this is a choice thing, and states have a lot of different pressures with regard to their cash assistance programs. Now, if we think about the question of what jobs are available and how people are prepared, it brings us back to the issue of training. Now, there are funds in the Act to train workers for green jobs and jobs in other fields, but the question is, what constitutes training for green jobs? Are they the same jobs, only you work on buildings with low carbon footprints, for example? How many people do we need to train, and how different is the training from traditional building construction or rehab jobs? The Vice President's Middle Class Task Force report on green jobs as a pathway to a strong middle class suggests the jobs are plentiful, pay better than comparable jobs in other sectors, and could be a means of upward mobility for both young and older adult workers. Yet many of the jobs they cite are in occupations that require extensive training or apprenticeships, such as plumbing and electricians. Although the report cites the $500 million in training funds for green jobs that's in the stimulus package, this is an amount equivalent to only 10% of the current Title I WIA funding, already woefully inadequate. And it's not clear how the existing training system will adapt its current structure to provide training for these jobs in a timely manner. We don't yet know how successful the newer training programs that focus on high-growth sectors of the economy are. These are some demonstration programs that the Labor Department now has in the field. But the stimulus package did include $750 million for new competitive grants in this area. Now, these are areas where further research or application of existing research to the job at hand would be helpful. The Stimulus Act also provides funds for children's development through Early Head Start, and the Child Care Development Block Grant. An Urban Institute study identified these as good vehicles for improving early childhood development while also supporting parents' work effort. But it is not clear how states will roll out these program expansions, and this is important in determining how effective they will be. But we must take account of the fact that not all policy takes place in Washington. The states play important roles in setting social policy. almost all of the programs we include in the safety net are shaped and at least partially funded by state governments, including unemployment insurance, TANF, workforce development, housing assistance, and Medicaid. In fact, SNAP, what we used to call food stamps, is the rare exception in that it is fully funded by the federal government. Unemployment insurance is a good example of the way in which states shape a policy and can override or attempt to override a federal policy initiative. You may have heard several governors say that they are going to reject federal unemployment compensation monies because they will require states to spend more money and eventually raise more money to cover new program costs. When pressed on this, most have said that they will accept some of the funds, but not the ones that have the unattractive strings. The provisions that they find most objectionable are those that are part of the Unemployment Insurance Modernization Act. This bill was originally introduced in Congress 2 years ago, but never passed by the Senate. It contains a number of features that would increase the probability that low-wage workers would receive compensation when they lose their jobs. The federal government will distribute up to $7 billion to states for maintaining or introducing some of these features into their systems. This includes an alternative base period, one that allows states to consider most recent work effort, and that increases the probability that people with short work tenures will be eligible. It also expands the definition of a legitimate job separation to include quits or discharge that are related to compelling family reasons, such as caring for a sick relative. It also allows workers seeking part-time jobs and not full-time jobs to receive compensation. It would include dependent allowances, which not all states have, and it would allow for a provision for workers who are in a training program that exceeds the usual UI benefit period of 26 weeks to also continue to receive compensation. Now, according to Urban Institute expert Wayne Vroman, actuarial estimates indicate that the federal monies that states would receive might cover the added cost for up to 7 years, a period that would exceed the average gubernatorial term in office. So one could argue that they could pass that problem along. It is possible that this reaction by the states is indicative of why it took Congress 2 years and an economic crisis to pass the UI Modernization Act. And even then, they did not address the question of the wage base for the employer tax. It's about $7,500. Now, states can opt to charge their taxes on wages above that, but they're not required to. If that base had been raised, then state revenues would increase without a state tax rate increase on employers, which all of the states are reluctant to do. Now, all of, but ignored in all this attention on the compensation side is the problem with the employment service. And the state is not only supposed to help you pay you when you're unemployed, it's supposed to help you find a new job. But with the switch to online and telephone applications and reporting, unemployed workers are mostly left on their own to find jobs, something that is even harder to do in these times. And what about other major programs that require state contributions? Under the stimulus package, the federal government is reducing the state match requirements for several programs, but hard-pressed states may still find that they are facing difficult choices. Now, I talked about the fact that they could use them for one-time cash assistance or to create subsidized jobs. Monitoring state responses will be important in determining how well the stimulus package is doing in helping families weather the recession and improve their long-run economic prospects. Now, one of the features of the Recovery Act is the emphasis on accountability and evaluation. Some might even say this is a recovery package for the research community, since it includes evaluation funds and places strict requirements on fund recipients to account for the money they received and assess its impact. We should not think of this only as a matter of record, but view this as an opportunity to identify programs that work and inform future policymaking. Thank you.
We'll take questions now.
Some of the things that were raised earlier concerning these large policy changes that could be made. One thing I haven't heard from the Obama administration is the issue of immigration reform, and specifically having to do with undocumented workers. I was wondering if either of you could speak to the impact of not having legal working status on low-wage workers, you know, specifically in that population.
It's not my area, but I can imagine that states, when they are told they're accountable for how they spend the stimulus package, I would expect they're going to be very, very careful in checking for papers. So there's a whole Cecilia Munoz, who was at the National Council of La Raza, has a position in the White House, and I assume at some point they will get to immigration issues, but I haven't heard anything on it. The other thing is that I've read anecdotally, and Aixa knows more about immigration issues than I do, is a lot of immigrants are going home given they don't have any access to the safety net. So our safety net is bad enough if you get laid off and you can try to get UI. If you're an undocumented worker and you get laid off, then you might as well go back to a low-cost area if you can quickly get back.
I think it's a problem not just with undocumented immigrants, but with legal immigrants. As well, because states differ in the kinds of support that they extend. And the other thing that some work that we're doing at Urban, which focuses on immigrant inclusion, deals with questions like language isolation. So when we think of the need for job training, we don't always think about the fact that there are other things that may keep workers from integrating into the mainstream workforce, and one of them seems to be, at least in Maryland, where we've been working, language isolation is another problem.
Thank you both. This is actually a pretty self-interested question. I wanted to follow up on, Margaret, your last comments about increased interest in evaluation and mandated evaluation funds, and just to ask a bit more about what areas in the ARRA are targeted for that. And then a more broad question to both of you, given the state we're in right now, what do you think needs to be some of the key questions in a research agenda on low-income working families?
Well, there are two kinds of things in the stimulus package about research. One of them is more about basic research, mm-hmm. Rather than policy-oriented research, in that both NIH and NSF have some money that they have to get rid of before June. So you should look for, if you're interested in that, there are announcements either out or coming out. But also in the money that's being distributed to states, they're required to set aside some money for evaluation. And then there's some, I think, in various little federal pots, but they're not large. And they're to evaluate the impact of the monies. So there's evaluation money attached to green jobs. There's evaluation money attached to some of the other funds. And those are ones where it's up to the state to figure out how they're going to use it, but they do have to use it for evaluation. And I assume they will decide, each state will decide how they want to go about getting that done.
I would encourage people to try to design studies in their area. What has struck me is after welfare reform, there were literally dozens of studies. Now, one of the things that was different, it was in the late 1990s and foundations were flush. We did a welfare panel study in Michigan. Urban Institute did the National Survey of American Families. APT and Mathematica and MDRC did dozens of states and cities. We're trying to put together a panel to study the effects of the recession, and they're going to be long-term effects on health and mental health, just like there were under welfare reform. You would also like to be able to see, are there people who got reemployed or didn't lose their houses because of changes in policy? So if you think of welfare reform, the amount of federal money involved was small, and the amount of people affected by welfare reform was minuscule relative to the number of people being affected by some aspect now of the financial crisis. So whatever your area, I mean, I was at a conference where people were talking about aging, and there are a lot of elderly people who were 75 years old who assumed they had enough money to live out the rest of their lives comfortably, and all of a sudden that annual return is going to be a lot less for most people if it was stock market basis. So again, are we going to see elderly people moving back in with their adults? Whatever aspect of social life you're interested in, it seems to me this is a very dramatic change, and yet there's nothing in the stimulus package. You know, Moynihan got in an earmark that the Census Bureau had to start gathering data, the Survey of Program Development, to study welfare reform. I haven't seen anything like that in the bill saying, I mean, I don't want the money necessarily for me, although that would be nice. I would have liked to see, you know, them say the Census Bureau ought to be gathering additional data on X, Y, and Z. So what I think did happen is Senator Spector, as part of his vote, got a very large chunk of money devoted to biomedical research. And so those are the people who are walking around our university with smiles because, you know, there's targeted money. I'm being too glib, so I'll just stop.
Bobby, Roberta.
Thank you, both of you. I've been noticing lately, I've been pretty excited about the policy, or the potential policy changes in relation to the federal poverty level. Rebecca Blank's activity and the, you know, the discussion in Washington. And I'm wondering two parts here. One, do you think that some of these, this basic direction of, you know, really finally changing an extremely outdated federal poverty metric will happen, and will it happen soon? And secondly, the distressing part for me in the projected changes are that they are separating out the federal poverty level metric from the eligibility criteria of different sort of programs, okay, supports and programs. And do you see any possibility of those being not separated out, if not immediately, quite soon afterward?
Well, I think many of the programs are not, in fact, equated to the poverty level. So that in fact, you could change something that's 130% of the poverty level to 100% of the poverty level if the poverty level goes up by 30%. Mm-hmm. So they always, in some sense they are independent already, because you can use a percent of poverty. I think the question is whether there will be a strong enough policy community to not have that change take place. But in the short term, you're going to have the pressure between more people becoming eligible and not more money to really accommodate it. So you then wind up making some decisions that wind up with fewer people being covered, even if you've expanded your poverty level. I mean, I think that we should think about changing the definition of poverty or the poverty level to be more realistic, but we shouldn't assume that that will automatically deal to an expansion, lead to an expansion in eligibility for most social programs.
Well, I'll go out on a limb on this. It may be that for the first time, the unions are really going to get around national health insurance, because that may be the only way to save General Motors, is to get the health benefits off the books. It strikes me that they're two very different. First of all, I think somebody mentioned the Employee Free Choice Act, and I think, you know, it won't happen until Al Franken gets into the Senate, because they won't have 60 votes. They may not have 60 votes even if he gets in, but they certainly need all the votes. Obama's clearly said recently that he's in favor of that. I see the bigger beneficiaries of that are people like the service employee unions, and so this notion that like the CBAs, you can use that in cities and you know, you can't outsource cleaning office buildings and things like that. So I don't, as somebody who reads about every day in the paper the auto unions having to give back things and what's going to happen if they collapse, I don't think they're focus is going to be on the low-wage labor market now. I think their focus is going to be on their union contracts in their firms. Maybe I'm wrong. Again, Laura Dresser knows more about unionization issues than I do.
Another question?
Yes.
Susan. I'm Susan Jaklik. I work in the research arm at Administration for Children and Families, and in particular on the research related to the child care subsidy program. And I guess my questions might assume that I don't know how much you know about the child care subsidy program, but I guess I couldn't pick which one, so you can answer either one of these, which is, we're certainly hearing a lot from the program office about how to spend their money. And so I'm wondering, you both seem very favorable about the child care subsidy program, and I'm wondering if you have any specific thoughts on what would be the best way to expand that program, or what research that we need to do on the child care subsidy program.
Well, I'm not an expert. There are a couple of my colleagues who are thinking about some of these issues right now. I think one of the drawbacks is that there isn't any requirement in there about quality issues, mm-hmm. which are very important. And another thing another person raises the question of how you use the child care subsidy expansion as also a vehicle for increasing employment and the quality of employment in the child care industry. These are not going to be solved in the stimulus package, but it would seem to me there's some issues about around access or availability and quality that would be important to look at. We have a study in the field right now looking at child care choices that's HHS funded that we don't know the answer to yet, but one piece of it is obviously the demand side as well as the supply side, and I think both of them need to be pursued.
Well, will you please join me in thanking Margaret and Sheldon for a thought-provoking presentation.